It's a small country, but a huge point of contention.
The Taiwan issue is the most sensitive issue in China's foreign relations.
Foreign relations, especially with Japan. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, what Taiwan means to Japan and China. Also, we check in on France on the 10th anniversary of a violent attack.
In Pakistan, the military chief just got more authority and criminal immunity for life.
From the looks of it, he is consolidating his own power.
Plus, a soccer scandal that has gutted teams in Turkey.
The Turkish Football Federation has suspended 1,024 players for gambling.
Not just players, referees as well.
That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being with us this Thursday. It is a solemn day in Paris as the city marks 10 years since the deadliest terrorist attack on French soil and remembers the victims.
Stéphane Albertini. Nick Alexander. Jean-Jacques Amyot.
130 names in all. That's how many people were killed when gunmen linked to the Islamic State, armed with rifles and wearing suicide vests, went on a violent rampage in Paris and its suburbs on the night of November 13, 2015.
Most of the victims had been enjoying a concert at the Bataclan Theater that night. Today's ceremony in a new memorial garden is just one example of a nation still coming to terms with what happened. The World's Jerry Haddon has our story.
On this night, 10 years ago, inside the Bataclan, around 1,500 people were singing along to the music of the American rock group Eagles of Death Metal. Then the gunman opened fire. 10 years later, some survivors are singing again. Choir of those who made it out and family members of victims who didn't. Among the singers was Miriam de Rote. She lost her son Mathieu in the Bataclan. Because her son was killed while listening to music, she told French television this week, music became for her a source of nightmares.
Mais là, je sens que cette chorale m'a redonné un effet de...
But then this choir came along and gave me motivation, she said. It lifted my spirits to begin living again.
Je chanterai d'abord pour Mathieu.
I'll be singing first and foremost for Mathieu, she said, but also for my daughters and the other victims and for all my companions with whom I share this ill fortune. Today's ceremony was broadcast live on national TV. A decade has passed, and many survivors say they're just beginning to find some peace. Arthur de Nouveau escaped the Bataclan, crawling over bodies until he reached an emergency door. Each fall, he says, the changing light and cooler air transport him back. What comes back is a kind of tenderness for the person I was back then, he says, and then the sadness of still feeling connected to it 10 years later, of thinking about all those who died, of having met so many grieving families. De Nouveau heads a survivors group called Paris for Life. The memories, he tells French TV, remain like an unquenchable inner fire.
Non, il me hante pas. J'ai fait assez de psychothérapie pour réussir à...
I am not haunted, he says. Through therapy, I was able to recover the memories but learn to keep them at a distance. Recently, there's been a lot of fictionalized versions of the attacks coming out, he says, but I don't watch them. I don't want someone else's version of events to replace my memories. The fictionalized retellings include a new series called The Living, about survivors trying to rebuild their lives.
Ceux qui étaient là, avec nous, qui nous fassent signe. Je voudrais vous revoir, c'est important.
There have been films, too, and dozens of documentaries on the attacks in a country still trying to make sense of what happened. After the attacks, police gained broad emergency powers to detain and search suspects, often without warrants. Some of those powers have passed into permanent law, provoking complaints from some human rights groups. Authorities say the aggressive response has helped prevent further large-scale attacks. But tougher security is not enough, says Elyamin Setoul. Setoul runs a de-radicalization program at Paris's Conservatory for the Arts and Trades. It trains social workers, teachers, and prison officials on how to dissuade potentially susceptible people from embracing violent ideologies.
On a des cours sur la géopolitique du Moyen-Orient, sur la religion.
We give classes on the geopolitics of the Middle East, he tells me, and on religion, psychology, the sociology of working class neighborhoods, and immigration. These are diverse subjects, he says, but they are all linked to radicalization. Satul says in the case of jihadist terrorists, recruiters seek out young Muslim men with a specific profile.
C'est souvent des jeunes qui ont des problématiques aussi d'intégration.
These are men who have problems integrating, he says, and finding their identity in French society, or they're consumed by their own personal social problems. They find comfort in radicalization, he says. It's like a band-aid to try to cover up their issues. Since 2018, Satul has trained around 300 professionals to help identify and de-radicalize potentially violent people. But in a country of nearly 70 million people, one program can't possibly reach them all.
Il faut se dire que la menace, elle est permanente, elle est lourde.
France's Armed Forces Minister Catherine Vautrin told French radio this week that the country remains on high alert for attacks. What's most worrying, she said, is the spike in underage people being drawn into extremism. Experts blame the internet and social media for that trend. Radical ideologues across the spectrum seek out new recruits online, from far-right fringe groups to religious extremists. Of the 10 jihadists who attacked Paris 10 years ago, one survived. Belgium-born Salah Abdeslam walked through the Bataclan, indiscriminately shooting people. He's in prison now, serving a life sentence. This week, Abdeslam made a surprising offer via his attorney, Olivier Renon.
On a une personne qui potentiellement aimerait pouvoir.
This is a man who wishes to meet with his victim, she told French radio. He's open to speaking about what happened. It's too early to call this reconciliation, she said, but he is reaching out in the name of appeasement. Some survivors have agreed as part of a restorative justice program meant to promote reconciliation. While Abdeslam was reaching out to survivors, police were arresting a former girlfriend of his, along with two others, for allegedly plotting another attack on French soil. The French government says it has thwarted six other terrorist plots so far this year. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon.
This music is called Requiem of Lights. It was written for this 10th anniversary of the Paris attacks and performed today by the Republican Guard Orchestra and the Radio France Choir at the New Memorial Garden.
China and Japan have a complicated relationship. They are close neighbors and the two biggest economies in Asia with extensive trade ties. But they also share some bitter history, which has been known to fuel diplomatic flare-ups between the two governments. Another of those just erupted between Japan and China, this time over comments by Japan's new prime minister about Taiwan. The World's Matthew Bell reports.
It was just 2 weeks ago when Chinese leader Xi Jinping reached out and shook hands with Japan's Prime Minister Sanae Takeuchi. It was all very cordial as they smiled for the cameras. The two leaders talked about a new era of cooperation between China and Japan. But just a few days later, things took a turn. Takeuchi was asked in the Japanese parliament, what would Japan do if China imposed a blockade or attacked the island of Taiwan? The prime minister answered by saying this scenario could lead to a military response by Japan's self-defense forces. The Chinese government took immediate offense.
There is only one China in the world, and Taiwan is part of China.
That's Chinese government spokesperson Chun Bin-hua speaking at a news conference in Beijing through an interpreter.
The erroneous remarks on Taiwan made by the Japanese leader at the council seriously violate the One China principle and is a blatant interference in China's internal affairs. We strongly deplore and firmly oppose it.
China's foreign ministry has insisted that Takeuchi retract her egregious comments about Taiwan. One Chinese official put out a statement on social media that threatened to cut off the prime minister's, quote, filthy head. Daisuke Kawai is a lecturer at the University of Tokyo. He explained to me over the phone that Takeuchi said something out loud that previous Japanese prime ministers always left unsaid.
She said that if China used force against Taiwan, she mentioned that the scenario like a blockade that could become a survival-threatening situation for Japan.
The phrase survival-threatening situation is a trigger under Japanese law for using military force. And Kawai says Takeuchi talking about it in the context of Taiwan represents a shift for Japan.
So previous prime ministers talked about the Taiwan contingency affecting Japan's security, but they stopped sort of linking it so explicitly to the legal conditions for Japanese military action.
Kawai says opinion polls show that the Japanese public sees China as a threat, and a broad majority views Taiwan as an independent democratic country. But he says people in Japan also realize that recognizing the island formally as being separate from China would create an immediate crisis with their large and powerful neighbor. And no one wants to go to war with China, he says. Beyond the spat with Japan, the government in Beijing also expressed anger this week toward the European Union. This is after Bi Kim-xiao, the sitting vice president of Taiwan, was invited to speak in the EU Parliament building in Brussels.
Peace in the Taiwan Strait is essential to global stability and economic continuity.
Xiao urged governments in Europe to expand their security and trade ties with Taiwan and to support its democratic freedoms. China's government was not happy to see a high-ranking Taiwanese official getting such a warm welcome at EU headquarters. Evan Medeiros is a professor of Asian Studies at Georgetown's School of Foreign Service.
The Taiwan issue is the most sensitive issue in China's foreign relations. Taiwan is central to the legitimacy of the Communist Party. China believes that Taiwan is part of China and wants the rest of the world to agree with them so eventually they can achieve unification.
After World War II, the losing army in the Chinese Civil War fled to Taiwan. That's where Chiang Kai-shek set up the Republic of China. When Mao Zedong founded the People's Republic of China on the mainland in October 1949, he made unification a top priority. This was about securing China's borders after 100 years of shame and humiliation imposed by foreign imperialist powers.
The Chinese Communist Party and Mao have always put unification of China, getting back those lost territories, Hong Kong, Tibet, Macau, and now Taiwan, as central to the identity of the People's Republic of China.
So for China, Taiwan represents unfinished national business. For the United States, support for Taiwan's democratic government and its military forces is rooted in the Cold War and an anti-communist worldview. Maduro says Taiwan does not represent a national security threat to China. It's more serious than that. Taiwan is a threat to the identity of the People's Republic and the Communist Party.
It suggests that you could have this entity that is separate and distinct, is a democracy, by the way, a Chinese democracy. So implicitly saying there is a political alternative. But most importantly, its very existence suggests that the Chinese Communist Party has not completed what Mao promised to do when he formed the PRC in October of 49.
This is what makes the current diplomatic spat between China and Japan more fraught. Evan Medeiros says there's another factor at play here.
The worst-kept secret in Washington is that President Trump has, at best, an ambivalence towards Taiwan.
Trump reportedly paused a $400 million arms deal for Taiwan in September and over the summer turned down a request from Taiwan's president to stop over in the United States during a planned trip to Latin America. President Trump is expected to make a state visit to China in April, and it's likely that he will be hearing a lot about Taiwan from the Chinese leadership. For the World, I'm Matthew Bell.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Climate change is causing severe flooding in Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia. It is a combination of rising sea levels and the city's rapid sinking, as we reported earlier this week. The situation is so dire that 3 years ago, Indonesian officials said enough is enough. They decided to build a brand new capital out in the forest. Patrick Nguyen went to the city in the making to see if it is living up to its promise.
I'm in front of a bathroom sink with a cup, about to do something that seems mundane, but is kind of a big deal. Down the hatch. Now, drinking unboiled water from the tap is something I would not do in most Southeast Asian cities. It's definitely a bad idea in Jakarta. Take it from Walid, a 24-year-old civil servant who, like many Indonesians, goes by one name. He's working on environmental issues in Indonesia's future capital.
What would happen if I drink the tap water in Jakarta?
Itu mungkin masih banyak E. coli dan
diare. He says you'd get E. coli and diarrhea. But the tap water is clean here. It's one of the many wonderful features of
Nusantara. Dua tahun sudah.
That's a government promo video for Nusantara, envisioned as a futuristic, eco-friendly capital. Forget tasty tap water. This capital is pitched as a city that'll be run on solar power, with electric buses and driverless cars, biometric scanners, and lots of AI, all surrounded by luscious jungle. It's not all there yet. Construction only started 3 years ago. It is brimming with young civil servants eager to bring this dream to life, like Kevin Juan Jonathan Jefferson, a 27-year-old in the public affairs office.
I have a calling to build Nusantara, to build this city. And I see Hong Kong, I see Singapore, and I also have the same dream to build Indonesia the same like the other countries.
Nusantara is about 2 hours by plane from Jakarta, on the lush island of Borneo, up in the hills away from the coast. The site was picked because there's no earthquakes, no volcanoes, and it's a good place to manage the dangers from climate change. For example, there's no flooding. But the clock is ticking. They need much of the city built by 2028. That is the year the president and his cabinet and all the lawmakers are expected to move here, to this paradise in the making. Birds and a canopy of trees near Nusantara's downtown. Some imagine Borneo as all pristine jungle, but much of it is actually plantations. With the new capital, Nusantara, they didn't mow down virgin forest. It's built on a former plantation that grew trees to grind up and make paper. It was kind of an ecological dead zone with little wildlife.
You can hear the birds right now. In 2022, almost no birds singing like this.
Mirna Safitri is the reason why. A former environmental activist, she was picked to be the top environmental official in Nusantara. Her team has been busy turning the landscape of Nusantara back into a rainforest, tree by tree, by scraping the black earth with garden hose and planting a diverse array of flora. More than half of the capital will be rainforest, brimming with frogs and birds, maybe proboscis monkeys with long, floppy noses. There really won't be any capital like it, if they can pull it off. Nusantara is in the middle of nowhere, and building a city twice the size of New York could end up costing more than $40 billion. This is in a country where many still don't get enough to eat.
Tunda dulu proyek-proyek yang mercusuar itu mau selesaikan apa namanya blok.
That is Indonesian politician Johan Rosihan saying to Parliament, Nusantara is just a prestige project. Put it on hold. Let's concentrate on giving people more rice. At the moment, the elected president Prabowo Subianto has not shown a ton of interest in Nusantara either. He's even decided to shrink next year's Nusantara construction budget by more than half. Some wonder if the government will eventually give up, leaving a half-built city in the jungle. This is a rumor that really bothers Basuki Harimuljono, Nusantara's top official. He says there's no going back.
We are at the point of no return. Fini, vidi, vici.
Veni, vidi, vici. We came, we saw, we conquered. Nusantara does already feel like a city. There's wide avenues and sleek offices draped in leafy vines. Still in the works is a parliament building and a Supreme Court, and some ambitious ideas in the master plan, like autonomous flying drone taxis.
Do you really think you can achieve everything, like flying taxis and things like that?
That's the ultimate goal. At least maybe not now. We have to make the priorities.
Basuki, in his 70s, says they'll get there in time. He calls Nusantara his child and can get teary-eyed talking about it.
This is not just a project. This is like a baby, so we have to manage this with the love.
Working under Basuki is an army of Gen Z civil servants. One of them is Kathleen Mora Berta. In her mid-20s, she helps oversee the city's state-of-the-art recycling center.
People keep asking us how we can be different from Jakarta. Yes, we are different from Jakarta. We put a lot of effort to make it different.
She feels Indonesia has no other choice. Not with its current capital sinking into the ground and always flooding due to heavier storms and rising sea levels. Projections show that by 2050, Jakarta could be one-third underwater. Kathleen says her generation is fervently motivated by the climate crisis and that building the city is their chance to actually do something about it. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Nusantara.
Venice, the Italian city full of art and canals, is perennially popular with tourists, arguably too popular. The city's residents are fleeing, and now Venice's local population has reached an all-time low, going all the way back to the Middle Ages.
Venice was one of the biggest cities of Europe in the Middle Ages. After Paris and Naples, Venice was the most populated.
That's Matteo Secchi, president of the group that runs the website, Venezia.com, which has been tracking the city's population for 25 years. According to the site, Venice's population is down to 44,995 people, which he attributes to Venetians needing to escape the hordes of tourists that show up each year.
We are not a city anymore. We are like a small village.
And he may have a point. Since the 1950s alone, Venice's main island has lost more than 120,000 full-time residents.
Landlords benefit from the current ratio of tourists to residents. They make more money on overnight Airbnb stays than on full-time renters. The city has tried to curb tourism while profiting from it by instituting an $11 daily fee for visitors. But as Jane DeMosto from We Are Here Venice told our partners at DW, it's not enough to discourage all those visitors. The city still needs to help its own residents.
What Venice needs is approach to looking after the city centered on the well-being of its residents.
So far, Venetians have not been squirting tourists with water guns like fed-up locals in Barcelona have been known to do. Not yet, anyway.
You're with The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. As long as there have been athletic competitions, people have been betting on sports. Or at least it seems that way. We've now entered an era of gambling that is dominated by apps that put betting at your fingertips. It is a shift that has created a whole new reality, or maybe a whole new mess. You might remember last year when the interpreter for baseball superstar Shohei Ohtani was caught in a massive gambling scandal that ended in prison time. This week, though, a scandal unfolding in Turkish men's soccer is on a whole other scale. Here's The World's Bianca Hillier.
If I were to tell you that a bunch of soccer players were caught in a gambling scandal, how many people would you guess? A few dozen? A few hundred? How about over 1,000?
The Turkish Football Federation has suspended 1,024 players for gambling.
1,024 players. Officials announced the mass suspensions this week in a press release. They say it's part of an investigation into betting across the country's professional soccer leagues, including the very top league and highly ranked players. Perhaps the best known player involved is 25-year-old Aaron Elmala.
Goal position, shot, goal! Aaron Elmala!
Almala plays for Turkey's national team and was supposed to play in World Cup qualifying games this weekend. Now he's off the roster and wrote on Instagram that his connection to all of this simply has to do with one bet placed 5 years ago. His team's president, Dursun Özbek, told reporters that should make a difference. He said someone who made a mistake 4 or 5 years ago and didn't realize what he was doing shouldn't get the same punishment as people who were placing bets just a few weeks ago. A few other top players named in the investigation are claiming complete innocence. But the issue gets more widespread as you go down into the lower divisions of Turkish soccer. 97% of the players suspended this week come from the bottom two leagues. For now, those entire divisions are stopping play, likely because so much of their roster isn't available. But it's not just the players who are coming under fire.
This might be the biggest referee scandal football's ever seen.
Just 2 weeks ago, news broke that hundreds of Turkey's soccer referees are also breaking gambling rules. An investigation found that 65% of them had illegal betting accounts, and a quarter of those referees were actively making bets. Whether or not they were betting on games they were refereeing is still under investigation. Turkish Football Federation President İbrahim Hacı Osmanoğlu detailed the news at a press conference. He said 10 referees placed more than 10,000 bets each, and one person made wagers over 18,000 times. This whole scandal, he added, is rock bottom for Turkish soccer. And on CNN, he likened the situation to a swamp. I'm not going to deal with flies, he said, and our goal is to drain the swamp. FIFA rules forbid players and officials from just about any involvement in betting. If found guilty, the minimum fine is $125,000 per person and a suspension of up to 3 years. That suspension is likely to be the biggest blow here, considering the World Cup is taking place in less than a year. Turkey still needs to qualify for the tournament, and they may need some of these suspended players to do it. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Pakistan has a powerful military, and today lawmakers gave the country's military chief an additional boost, expanding his authority and granting him lifelong immunity from criminal prosecution. The move is being widely denounced as a blatant power grab and a significant step on the path to authoritarianism. Other important changes, like reducing checks on the military, came with it. Aisha Sadiqa is an expert on Pakistan's military. She joined us from King's College in London and explained the implications of the changes on the country's justice system.
Judges that do not conform to the will of the military will get retired, will get pushed out. And in fact, as we speak, two senior judges of the Supreme Court of Pakistan have resigned in protest.
And these changes to the judiciary are that there's been a new court made that is higher than the Supreme Court. And that's seen as something that would rubber stamp military decisions?
Yes. So what they've done is the Supreme Court of Pakistan, which was essentially the highest court, and now there's going to be a separate constitutional court where judges will be appointed by the prime minister in consultation with the Supreme Judicial Council. But Supreme Judicial Council will now have judges who are friendlier to the military establishment, basically crowding out and weakening any alternative institution in the country which could challenge the military and its power.
So the change you're saying basically puts the military above the courts.
Yeah, I mean, this is essentially what's going to happen. It's going to de facto boost the military's power and boost authoritarianism. Technically, the army chief's tenure had been extended from 3 years to 5 years, which finishes in November of 2027. But now, as Chief of Defense Force, he has given himself 5 extra years. So even if he retires in 2027, he remains chief of defense force till 2030.
Wow.
Which means that he will be overseeing the next elections in 2029.
And the man we're talking about here is Field Marshal Syed Asim Munir.
Yes.
I want to understand the relationship between the military and civilian government up until this point. The military has been powerful in the government for many years, correct?
Yes.
And how did that work? Was it kind of a power sharing between the civilian government and the military, or has the military always played a major role in the executive branch?
Historically, military has come and usurped power. It was kind of a revolving door. You would have a military president, then from a martial law administrator, they would turn to military presidents. And that rule would continue for about 10 to 11 years. And then they would get unpopular, they would get pushed back. And the military would then surrender or kind of the power to, you know, hold elections to civilian government. Now, in 2008, that was the last when a martial law took place, which was General Musharraf. He ended his military rule in 2008. Now, after that, essentially, a new thinking, I believe, took place in the military, which was that they decided they would no longer control the state, but control governance. So they very slowly and gradually edged into a partnership with civilian governments where they would share power.
So, Aisha, do you see this then as a continuation of this long tradition of consolidation of power under the military, or is it more surprising to you than that?
It's not just continuation. The civilian authority has completely diluted. I mean, the civilian prime minister is just there in name. The actual running of the state is being done effectively by the army.
Can you tell us more about Field Marshal Syed Asim Munir? His rise through the military ranks has been called meteoric. What has made him so powerful?
Firstly, he has encouraged the fear within the civilians of Imran Khan. The military has built this narrative that if Imran Khan comes to power, he's going to try people for corruption, he's going to go after them. Therefore, they should come together behind him.
So uniting against a common enemy.
Yes.
Do you have a sense of whether Munir is consolidating his own personal authority or if he's trying to make the military as a whole more powerful in Pakistan?
From the looks of it, he is consolidating his own power. And now he, as army chief, has become head of the three services as well, as being the army chief. So there is no concept of, you know, equality among the three services.
So Munir also now has lifelong legal immunity. What do you think the implications of that are?
If tomorrow, let's suppose that he declares martial law and he strips the constitution, anyone who takes over, any civilian who wants to try it as and consider it as an act of treason, will not be able to try him, because he's got immunity for life.
And how is the Pakistani public reacting to these changes?
Pakistani public is not demonstrating, if that's what you mean, but they're very unhappy. People are not speaking, but in whispers. People look at it as more chaos coming in the future, more instability. It may have strengthened him temporarily, but it means a lot of chaos for the country in the future.
Is there any recourse for people who might be unhappy with this move, or is it completely a done deal?
Well, it's a done deal. I mean, where do people go to? I mean, the only institution which could perhaps question the military or poke the military is the Supreme Court, and that has been neutered. I think the only way, perhaps, there would be a challenge that Field Marshal Syed Asim Munir may get will be from his own institution. I mean, the only way right now where he would go, his power would reduce as if there is a challenge from within his own military. And a lot depends on what position Donald Trump's administration takes towards Pakistan and towards India. if relations improve with India and if Pakistan relations between Pakistan and U.S. mellow down, it may have an effect. And then he'd probably get a challenge from his own institution.
Aisha Sadiqa joined us from the Department of War Studies at King's College in London. She's the author of Military Inc. Inside Pakistan's Military Economy.
And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed.
Turkey has grounded its C-130 military cargo planes following a crash this week in the Republic of Georgia that killed 20 military personnel. That cargo plane was flying from Azerbaijan to Turkey when it went down on Tuesday. The cause is being investigated.
South Africa's president is criticizing the U.S. decision to boycott the G20 summit in South Africa next weekend. President Cyril Ramaphosa said today the U.S. should rethink whether boycotts are effective, adding, in my experience, it doesn't work. When President Trump made the announcement last week that the U.S. would not participate in the meeting, he cited his widely rejected claims that white people in South Africa are persecuted.
And finally, from the museum heist desk, the latest is in Syria. Several ancient statues from the Roman era were stolen from the National Museum of Damascus. The museum discovered this on Monday. Yesterday, the culture ministry released drawings of six missing statues that authorities believe were stolen by an individual working alone. The theft has angered Damascus residents. The museum reopened in January as Syria began the long process of rebuilding and recovery after 14 years of civil war and the collapse of a brutal dictatorship. And those are a few things you might have missed.
An American delegation visited Lebanon this week. It's part of a wider effort by the Trump administration to pressure the Lebanese government to disarm and defund Hezbollah, the Shia militant group that opposes Israel. Israel has been on a mission to dismantle the group, killing most of its top leaders in a series of attacks last year. Despite all this, Hezbollah remains a force in Lebanon. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
Last Friday, residents of a village in southern Lebanon woke up to scenes of destruction. Israeli airstrikes hit three towns in the area close to the border with Israel. Mustafa Zidane's home was among those destroyed. Zidane told the Associated Press that shortly before the strike, he had been notified that one of his neighbors was, quote, a terrorist. He said he wasn't home at the time, and when he returned, he saw that his home had been destroyed. Shortly after that attack came another. This one, caught on a video by a resident, shows huge balls of fire lighting up the night sky. Israel has carried out near-daily strikes in Lebanon despite agreeing to a ceasefire last November. They have left the residents in the south exhausted, says Hanin Qatar with the Washington Institute.
No one wants another war. Everybody wants a solution, especially the Shia community who are going to be paying the price for this.
The United Nations Human Rights Office has verified the death of at least 103 civilians in Israeli attacks since the ceasefire. It says more than 80,000 people have been displaced. Hezbollah's leader, Naim Qassem, addressed the Lebanese people in a televised speech this week. He said Israel doesn't want to withdraw from Lebanon because it wants to control the country politically, economically, socially, financially, and geographically. We will not give up our weapons, he said, which give us our resolve and strength to defend ourselves. Qatar says while defiant publicly, Hezbollah's leaders know that they no longer have the same capabilities as before.
They have been weakened militarily. They lost most of their weaponry, especially the strategic weapons, and they do not have a command structure anymore.
Still, she says, the group hasn't lost all of its influence in Lebanon.
They still have a valid political representation inside the parliament. They want to maintain that.
Hezbollah was formed in the 1980s, and it has been the strongest political and military actor in Lebanon since then. Its goal was and is to oppose Israel with the backing of the government.
I think what Hezbollah is presenting is an impossible mission to the Lebanese state.
Karim Safiuddin is a researcher based in Lebanon.
It's suggesting that the Lebanese state must take responsibility to kick Israel out today before tomorrow. It should allow Hezbollah to maintain its weapons. And it should allow Naeem Assem to decide when a war can or cannot take place.
The reality on the ground has changed since October 7th. Hezbollah doesn't enjoy the same support from its biggest backer, Iran, and the U.S. is putting pressure on the government to disarm the group. This week, American officials in Beirut also emphasized that the flow of cash to the group must end. Researcher Karim Safiuddin says there are questions around how decisive the Lebanese government is on countering Hezbollah.
Because you have a modest security transition government, you don't have a very transformative government.
Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has threatened to widen the war in Lebanon once again if the group doesn't surrender its weapons. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Getting sick from time to time is a fact of life. That is especially true during the holidays, which are just around the corner, due to the number of people traveling. But what if your whole life is travel? Paul Salopek is a National Geographic explorer. He's been walking the global path of human migration for his project, the Out of Eden Walk, for the past 12 years. We asked him recently what he does to stay healthy.
To start out with, I have to say that I was 50 when I started this walk. And so I've traveled an awful lot as a foreign correspondent. So I've been exposed to a lot of different kinds of bugs and all in different environments. And so I guess you could say that I had a pretty good flora getting off on the first step. So
you had a lot of antibodies already.
That's right. My immune system was probably pretty bulked up. That's number one. And number two is that walking, as you know, and increasingly studies are showing, is actually really good for keeping your immune system healthy, keeping your whole bod actually happy. So I would just say those two kind of preventive things were probably the best possible antidote to any disease or kind of illness that I could encounter walking tens of thousands of kilometers across the world.
Mm. So did you ever get very sick or injured in a way that stopped your travels for a while?
Yes, I had some problems. I twisted a knee pretty seriously in the Caucasus Mountains, rolling down the mountains into Georgia. I've had gastric distress at various stages of the walk, assorted fevers, most of them nameless. I had no idea what they were. And of course, I caught COVID along the way too.
You have walked through some very remote places. You mentioned an injury when you were walking through the Caucasus. I'm wondering what you do to prepare before you enter into a rather remote stretch of your walk where you might not have access to a hospital or a drugstore or supplies you might need.
So I carry a first aid kit that's pretty thorough. It has including prescription painkillers and antibiotics. I started this journey with some medical training. I went through a 6-week course embedded with the U.S. Air Force years ago. They kind of basically get EMT training. But also, I kind of put myself at the doorstep of local healers. And that's everything from primary health care clinics in economically struggling economies that offer just really basic kind of interventions. And I must say, Carolyn, the treatment was incredible. I've been treated by shamans. I went to a spiritual cleanser in Uzbekistan, sort of wasn't going there to seek help, but she kind of asked me to kind of see if I, you know, she wanted to practice on me. And this was a woman named Shaklo Tashabaeva in the old Silk Road town of Kokand in Uzbekistan in Central Asia. And she had set up shop under a tree outside of the local cemetery where she was rubbing a glass full of ashes over patients whose ailments were not being cured in the local hospital, right? So people might go to the local hospital as a first recourse, but if it was a chronic illness or maybe even a very serious one that was getting worse and that wasn't reacting to modern medicine, they would go to Shaklo, and she would recite prayers over them and kind of rub a glass full of ashes over their bodies and then basically burp out. I mean, it sounded like a belch, the evil spirits that were inhabiting these patients. And she did that to me, too.
Was there an ailment that you were going to her for?
You know, I felt a little awkward because I was feeling great, but she was quite insistent. And you know, I was in a public square in front of a cemetery, so I didn't, you know, I felt like, okay, well, why not? It's another part of the experience. So I said, yeah, well, I'm a guy who's walking around with a heavy pack. My back gets sore sometimes, so she rubbed it on. She rubbed this kind of glass of ashes on my back, and yeah, it felt great. I think just the human touch, right, is enough to kind of, you know, it's very ancient, just, you know, touching each other to kind of heal each other, if nothing else in our minds, right? So, yeah, it was great.
You said you carry a first aid kit with you. I'm wondering if there's one essential item that has been more useful than any others.
Probably the most used thing would be the same thing that you have, you know, in your bathroom behind the mirror is, you know, like something for a headache, right? Something for some aches and pains. If you've kind of walked 30 kilometers a day and it's been super hot, or you feel dehydrated, you're feeling a little bit nauseous. So I would say, you know, the top things would be like a little bit of analgesic, maybe on very rare cases, some antibiotics for a gastric ailment that wasn't quickly healing itself, right? Because you don't want to dehydrate. And those two things are probably the most useful. For some strange reason, I don't get blisters. So I've not really worn, you know, gone through my supply of Band-Aids. Mm. They're still there. Yeah. So that's about it. You know, there were some kind of cultural healing methodologies along the way that I wrote about, but I certainly wouldn't want to subject myself to. I mean, Shaklo was a very, you know, benign and even interesting and kind of empathetic one. But there was, I ran across a woman who was doing the fire cure in Saudi Arabia. And that, you know, that was something I'd never seen before, where she was pressing hot irons into somebody.
Oof.
To cure their ailments. I did not volunteer for a demonstration.
Yeah, I can see why. Yeah.
So yeah, it's been interesting to see how human beings think about illness, you know, both psychologically and physically, and how we come up with cures, particularly when there aren't too many resources around.
Yeah. Was there ever a point when you thought you might have to turn around or stop your journey because of illness, injury, anything like that?
You know, up until now, thankfully, knock on wood, knock on these old me's, not yet, right? But who knows? You know, it's our supply of cartilage in our bodies is sort of finite, and so I'm very aware that I'm sort of racking up the miles.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to be more mindful about how I use my body, right? I didn't used to do things like stretch in the morning. I'm starting to do that now. You know, I'm being aware, you know, of how long I've been on the trail and how many miles and years have gone by walking. And so I'm trying to be a little more careful about all these, this amazing walking machine that we all carry around with us, the body.
That's National Geographic Explorer Paul Salopek. Thanks as always for chatting, Paul.
It's always a pleasure, Carolyn. Thank you.
Finally today, the flight to freedom of a flamingo. This story began in southern England at a wildlife sanctuary called Paradise Park 10 days ago. That's when the sanctuary put out an APB that a flamingo named Frankie had flown out of her enclosure despite her wings being clipped to prevent such an escape.
The sanctuary called on the public to report sightings of the bird so she could be captured and brought home. After a week of searching, Paradise Park now confirms that Frankie has taken up residence on a beach in Brittany, France, 120 miles away.
Park officials say they are resigned to her staying there, reassured that she appears well-fed and healthy, leaving Frankie to her French-found freedom.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you again tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.